We're on the record. It is Monday, February 9th, 2009. It's 1:30 in the afternoon. This is the Senate Judiciary Committee. We have a quorum to conduct business. Senator Terry was here, Senator Wilkowski, myself, Senator French. There are two things on the agenda today, the first of which is a confirmation hearing for Ms. Terry Thurbin. And Ms. Thurbin, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Nice to see you. Thanks for being here. The letter we have from the governor says that although this position does not require legislative confirmation, it is important that the individual have the confidence of legislators, and therefore I am submitting the name of Ms. Terry Thurbin under Alaska Statute 3905053. So that's the legal posture in which we find ourselves. Welcome Senator Elton to the committee at 1:31, and we'll turn it over to you to introduce yourself, tell us a little bit about your background and why you want to continue as the Chief Administrative Law Judge.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Terry Thurbin, the Chief Administrative Law Judge for the state of Alaska, which means I'm the agency head for the Office of Administrative Hearings and have a few duties above and beyond the normal running of the agency, including hearing cases myself and reviewing applications for the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission and administering the Code of Hearing Officer Conduct and a whole host of really fascinating duties that when I went into this, when I volunteered, if you will, or sought to be the state's first Chief Administrative Law Judge a little over 4 years ago, I knew it would be an interesting challenge. That was a big part of the attraction. I had no idea quite how many dimensions there were going to be to this job and how much I was going to learn along the way about how the executive branch of state government works and how it interfaces with the legislature and the judicial branch, above and beyond what I already knew from my private practice. As far as my background, if you want to really go back to the beginning, which is a little bit more than 50 years ago.
I reviewed it. Maybe you can just sort of start from the last 20 years.
Okay. Oh, that worked out really well. For the last 20 years, I was initially teaching at a law school in California, my alma mater, University of the Pacific McGeorge School of Law, when I got the bug to come to Alaska, or at least to get out of California. And Alaska was where my sights were set. And I came here and practiced privately for a little over 12 years, mostly natural resources and environmental law, but along the line, of course, you do a certain amount of other kinds of law when you're in that practice, including advising business clients on contracts, a little bit of occupational licensing, the occasional little resolution of a property dispute between people in a marital dispute that just happened to be folks that walk in the door and need your help. And so I had a little bit of variety in my practice, but after doing that for better part of 12 years, I spent a year at the Department of Law doing more or less the same thing as an assistant attorney general working primarily for Department of Environmental Conservation and Department of Natural Resources. So it was pretty much the same thing, but along the line, I developed an interest in administrative law and administrative adjudication processes. So when Senate Bill 203 was being considered and eventually...
And as I recall, the author of Senate Bill 203 is within our immediate presence.
I think he's just two, Mr. Chair, he's two people to the right there. When it was going through the process, I followed it out of interest than anything else, and kind of got excited about the prospect of perhaps maybe being able to be the one who kicked this agency off on the right foot. Had it in mind, I'd volunteer for one term, work really hard for what I thought would be 5 years. Didn't know at the time we were going to find that this was subject to the March 1st expiry, which makes it a little less than 5 years.
So you've been in the job now for how long, Ms. Thurbin?
A little over 4 years.
Okay.
And
it's but it would be you're asking for reappointment to a five-year term? I see.
Yeah, the first term ended up being truncated a bit because of the Title 39 provision for the March 1st expiry date. Had it in mind that I would just do this for 5 years, get the agency off on the right foot, and as time went on and we got past the initial push, which took a lot more than the 12 to 18 months I thought it would be. I envisioned everything would be all shipshape within the first 18 months. I was very naive about what it takes to get a new agency off the dime. I was also not taking into account our first couple of years we would have huge spikes in the caseload and a pretty big backlog that we inherited from the agencies that were consolidated, the hearing units that were consolidated into this agency. So long story short, I didn't get as much done in my first term as I'd like to, and the main reason as I mulled this decision over, I asked the governor to reappoint me, is because there's still a little bit more that I'd like to do. I'd like to continue shepherding us through the process of making the hearings the hearing processes more efficient and more timely, which we've made good strides on in the last couple of years, but we're not all the way there yet. And then there's a whole host of ancillary functions meant to improve administrative adjudications in the state, including, in addition to administering the Code of Hearing Officer Conduct that applies to all state hearing officers and administrative law judges, it includes doing training and monitoring the hearing function and making recommendations to the legislature for improvement. And we just frankly haven't had enough time to do as much of those things as I'd really like to do.
Well, just let me interrupt you for 1 second to welcome Senator McGuire to the committee and let her know that we are considering the reappointment to the Chief Administrative Law Judge position of Ms. Terry Thurbin, who was the, I think, the first and only Chief Administrative Law Judge we've had in the state. Yeah. Please proceed.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So here I was facing the decision, would I like to continue or was I just going to go on and do something else? And I decided there was still a little bit more I could do, and that's the sole reason I asked the governor to reappoint me. I'm not a fan of, from myself personally, of dynasties. I like going in and tackling the challenge and then moving on. And I really struggled with whether I wanted a second term. And if we'd gotten everything done that I wanted to do in that first few years, then I probably would not have put my name in again. But I think with the governor's grace to reappoint me, and if you have confidence in me continuing, I'd be happy to spend a few more years seeing if we can't bring it to the next level and make some more traction on the improvement of administrative adjudication for the executive branch.
Thank you for that opening statement. We have a question from Senator Elton.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Terry, thanks for the service and thanks for wanting to come back. I just want to make sure that I understand. You used a few phrases here in the last part of the statement. A little bit more to do, you know, that it's been a struggle. In a few more years, am I correct in presuming perhaps that you may not be interested in staying for the 5 years?
Well, I think it's fair, through the chair, Senator Elton, I think it would be fair to say I don't know at this point. 5 years seems like a daunting amount of time when I've just spent in a little over 4 years when I've accomplished what I think we as a group have accomplished. But by the same token, as we all know, 5 years goes by in the blink of an eye these days. And so I'm not guaranteeing anybody that I'll be here for the full 5-year term, but by the same token, none of us can guarantee that. We step out and get hit by a bus and not be here more than 2 more days. So.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Elton. My question has to do with the relationship, if any, between the Workers' Comp Appeals Board, which I think you referenced in one of your earlier statements, and your job. And can you tell me, you know, the degree to which those two bodies or you and that body interact and cooperate?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, the legislation that created the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission gave two duties to the Chief Administrative Law Judge. One is to review applications for positions, both the attorney chair position and the representatives of management and labor lay commissioners for that appeals commission. To review the applications, to recruit essentially for those openings, review the applications, and send up a minimum of names to the governor for consideration. 2 if it's a lay commissioner, 3 if it's the attorney chair. So every year, sometimes twice a year if there's an early exit by one of the commissioners, but at least once a year we'd go through a recruitment process, get in the names, review the applications, and forward a list to the governor. The second thing we have to do, when I say we, it's a duty of the Chief Administrative Law Judge. It's not an agency duty of the Office of Administrative Hearings, and that is to appoint pro tem chairs when the attorney chair has a conflict or is going to be absent for more than 10 days. We've had to appoint pro tem chairs maybe 4 or 5 times at the most, and they've all been conflict cases. You have currently a chair there who never seems to take much leave, and so we haven't had to cover absences. But those are the only two functions that the Chief Administrative Law Judge was assigned that is specific to that commission. Above and beyond that, of course, the statutory duty to monitor administrative adjudication processes, survey the participants, comment to the legislature on improvement, that would apply to that commission as well, but that applies across all of the executive branch adjudications. Did that answer your question?
It did. Thank you. And I just have one follow-up, and then I'll turn it over to Senator Wilikowski. I've got to believe you're doing a great job because you sail along, you know, week after week, month after month, and I don't read about you in the newspaper, unlike some of us. and so I guess my question is, you know, give me a feel for what the one or two more controversial topics that you've worked on without sort of digressing into, you know, how you ruled or so forth, but just give me an idea, if you will, about, you know, the more hot button issues that come your way.
Well, Mr. Chairman, there's no denying throughout all of state government, the certificate of need cases are controversial. And for our agency as a whole, as well as in my own personal case docket, we've had the tension of competing businesses slugging it out through an administrative adjudication process over certificates of need, whether they should get one, whether they have to get one. So those cases, those are the ones that if you had caught the few times we were referenced in the newspaper, it would more likely than not be for a certificate of need case. Once in a while, one of the professional licensing cases will draw fire. Certainly, they are hotly contested, as everybody can appreciate when you've got a doctor or nurse or a vet or even a barber with their professional license, their ability to practice their profession on the line. Those cases can not only be contentious, they can sometimes draw attention in the media, though most of them do not. Draw a lot of attention anyway. And they also provide us with some of our most interesting issues, both the application denials and the disciplinary cases. So I would say those are the two areas, but we also do child support hearings.
Oh my goodness,
We do the administrative child support order hearings for the Child Support Services Division. And though those probably don't get much play in the press, and that I can recall, they do get a few appeals that go up through the court system. And you probably get some constituent letters about those cases. But the one thing I think I'm most proud of that we've accomplished in that part of the docket is when we have several hundred of these a year, we're able to resolve many of them through an informal, almost an alternative dispute resolution process, where we get the parties on the phone and help them understand the limits of the law, the requirements of the law, and ultimately the two parents and the Child Support Services Division will sometimes come to a stipulated agreement that we can memorialize simply and not have to go through the elaborate and costly exercise of writing a detailed decision with findings and conclusions.
Sure, and thank you for that answer. Sure. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was a supporter of moving the administrative law judges into one system. I think that's a good system. I think it seems to be working well. On the other hand, the Workers' Comp Appeals Commission, I had concerns at the time that it was done, and based on the performance and conversations that I've had with people in the system and that work with the system, I'm not sure it's working the way it should be working. It seems to be extremely expensive, number one. And what I'm hearing from people, and I'm a former workers' comp hearing officer, so I hear from a lot of the people in the system, it's sort of created this this vortex where they're doing a lot of interlocutory appeals. And they're taking, particularly when employees win cases, employers are appealing, and they're going up and they're getting kind of caught in this vortex which extends the employee's case longer and longer and longer. In the meantime, they're not getting any compensation. And then they're simply remanding back to the workers' comp board, and then when the employer gets another decision they don't like, they just reappeal back to the Workers' Comp Appeals Commission. And so there's a lack of finality. I think the interlocutory appeals is a big problem in the system, and I'm not sure that the system is balanced in favor of employees. In fact, I think it's just the opposite. I think employees are suffering under this system. I think if you did a study and asked the percentages of who's winning which cases, you'll find that the cases are falling down significantly, probably in favor of employers. Those are the complaints and concerns that I've heard from people in the system. Has there been any kind of research or study done in this area on how effective it's actually been?
And before you answer, Ms. Thurbin, if you would be so kind as to include a definition for the non-lawyers in the audience and for those of us who are a little fuzzy, being out of law school for some time, as to what an interlocutory appeal is, that'd be helpful.
Sure, I'll give it a try, Senator French. The interlocutory appeal process, as I understand it, in the Workers' Comp Appeal Commission venue under their regulations is, and this is similar to how an interlocutory appeal would occur in the courts, is where the parties who are before the lower tribunal, in this case the Workers' Compensation Board, they can pursue an issue up to the next level on appeal before their case is fully developed and ready to go on appeal as a whole. So they can take an issue, sort of race up to the next level of court and get resolution of that issue, which in effect then goes back and directs the lower tribunal, the Workers' Compensation Board, on how to deal with this particular issue. It seems to me in these cases often it comes up in terms of questions about whether an additional medical examination should be ordered, a supplemental independent medical examination, for example. Does that answer your question about interlocutory?
Yes, that portion, yes, but I know Senator Wilikowski probably wants more on the...
Senator Wilikowski, this last year, during 2008, we did include the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission cases that had closed in some period of time before we sent out our surveys in our annual survey exercise, where this is one of the ancillary functions I spoke of that we're ratcheting up slowly but surely. We started with our own cases. We've added the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission parties to the survey project. We received 12 responses, 10 of which were filled out and 2 of which the party said, I have nothing to say. So bearing in mind that the only feedback I've got is those 10 responses, certainly the perception I saw of the workers' comp case area as a whole, not just of the appeals commission, but of the board level proceedings. And I say that because several of the commenters, you could tell they were commenting about the workers' comp board level cases. They could say the narrative comment would make it clear they were commenting on a particular board member or hearing officer, not on the appeals commission. So we have to look at those 10 responses as being partly reacting to the board level proceedings and partly to the appeals commission proceedings. And we did see a fair amount of comments along the lines of what you outlined, people who did not think the process was working, mainly that it was taking too long. I don't remember seeing any that where they pointed it to the interlocutory appeal opportunity to the commission as being the principal problem, but certainly amongst those 10 people, several of them did have that perception. And the other thing that was kind of interesting to me, if we compared the yes and no answers that we asked all the parties, if we compared those to those similar questions for our own cases, we ended up with, and I don't mean to pat OAH on the back for this, but we ended up with a significantly higher percentage of our people who responded being happy with the process, even if they weren't happy with the result in the case. And it was the flip side of that in the workers' comp, the 10 completed workers' comp surveys. Even if they liked the result, sometimes they didn't like the process. So, that's as much as I can tell you at this point. I haven't studied it any more in depth than that. I have not monitored very many Workers' Comp Appeals Commission proceedings as far as observing them or talk to the parties directly myself.
Quick follow-up. Is that something that we should address with your office or with Workers' Comp? I mean, if there's a problem there, which it seems that your limited data reveals there is, I mean, you have a suggestion on how we can try to fix it?
At this point, Senator, I think it would be too soon for me to have a solution until I've done a better job of identifying the problem, and it certainly would be appropriate for my agency to be directed to focus a little bit more on the workers' comp area, which we rolled them into the surveys this last year in part because we realized that's an area where we might get some meaningful feedback. They have enough of a caseload and enough of a variety of parties appearing before them that it was a conscious choice to go to them first before we worry about CFEC or employment security. But it would certainly be fair for us to be directed to look at it closer and be more aggressive, if you will, about contacting parties, surveying the parties a little bit more, fully observing the proceedings. But I don't have any ideas on solutions at this point yet because I'm not sure I've identified a specific problem from just that small data set.
Senator Elton and then Senator Terrio.
Thank you. And I just want to make sure that I understand the interlocutory process. Am I correct in listening to the question and listening to the answer? So at one level, I mean, the process can be bumped up to, for lack of a better term, the appeal group, which would be you, for direction on a specific issue that is being held by the lower court. And so that would delay the process because that goes up, then comes back down for further determination. I mean, that just seems to me, if my understanding is correct, I mean, that's not what happens between the district court, the superior court, or the superior court and the Supreme Court. You don't send part of an issue up to the next level to get a reading so that you can make a determination at the lower level. Am I just missing something here, or did I misunderstand the answer?
Well, Senator, no, I don't know that you're missing something so much as there, I As I understand the jurisdiction of the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission, which is really not part of my agency, and I don't profess to understand it entirely, but they were put in place not just to fulfill solely the function the Superior Court used to fill in taking appeals from the Workers' Compensation Board, but there was an element of their jurisdiction, I believe, that was meant to make them almost the equivalent of the policymaker on workers' comp legal issues. They have, I believe they have a statutory provision that dictates the extent to which the Supreme Court, when appeal goes to the next level, must defer to their decisions on the law, and whether or not the Supreme Court, or whether or not the court system revisits fact issues. So there's a slightly different role that the commission itself is filling that the Superior Court would not have been filling. That said, there is the potential for interlocutory appeals between lower levels of courts and higher levels of courts within the judicial branch, and even between executive branch agencies such as mine and the court system. It is not exercised quite as freely as I think we see in the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission setting, at that point I probably need to stop and not confuse us more by speculating about whether the statutory provisions justify that, or if this is an issue of their regulatory authority that they have articulated in their regulations. I'd certainly be happy to look into it a little bit more and even speak with the chair who prepared their regulations and get some information from her if you'd like.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Just a point of clarification before we go to Senator Terrio. The Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission is not really under your supervision.
Yes, it's not under our supervision at all.
You help nominate the positions, the officers, the judges to that commission, and that's more or less the extent of your involvement.
That's true, Senator, except when we provide a chair pro tem, which I could do by hiring a contract person to serve as the chair pro tem, the temporary chair, or if we have someone who has the minimum workers' compensation background in our shop, we essentially loan them someone. But even then, it's not treated like an Office of Administrative Hearings case. We don't carry it on our case list. We don't give it an OAH case number. We're segunding an employee over there to help them cover a conflict case. So yes, you're right, and I appreciate that clarification. I should have clarified it in response to Senator Elton's comment.
Senator Terrio.
Thank you. That was exactly my first question to refresh myself, and I was a little bit confused by Senator Wilkowski's question that it is separate. And so really, I mean, when 203 passed, specifically workers' comp was out. It was separate legislation to deal with some of the allegations of political charging that gave you the limited interaction with workers' comp that you have. I mean, and now you're just bringing in some tracking, gathering up some data on their cases. Is that right? I mean, you said you brought the review or tracking into your shop this year.
Yes, and if I could just clarify that, Senator Terrio, the mandate for us to monitor hearing functions throughout the whole executive branch and to survey hearing participants has always been there, and it has always applied beyond the Office of Administrative Hearings, the 40 or so categories of cases we hear. But we, due to limits of resources and the difficulty sometimes of getting the other agencies to turn their resources to giving us a parties list so we can mail out surveys, we did not push early on to add, to essentially send out surveys to anybody except our own case parties. We did that for a year, year and a half or so, and then we started adding other case parties in. We started with workers' compensation at the Appeals Commission level. My intent this year is to add the Workers' Compensation Board level and perhaps some of the others, some of the whether it's the DMV or the Health and Social Services in-house public assistance type hearings. We haven't quite figured out what's going to be doable, but certainly I would like to extend it out to the rest of the workers' compensation docket above and beyond just the Appeals Commission cases, but you're absolutely right. This is a new development as far as getting information on them. Up until this last year when we did the surveys, I had observed a proceeding or two, talked to some people who'd been involved in board level workers' compensation proceedings, but had not done anything sort of systematic to study workers' compensation processes.
And then, Mr. Chairman, and we wrote that section so that hopefully other agencies that initially were very opposed to even being considered to be part of the purview of the new shop that over the years they would perhaps become more comfortable and feel like, you know, they would want to be added. So I'm not sure the problem that Senator Wilkowski was talking about, whether the fact that your shop has timelines for timely decisions, you know, whether that them coming in would either mirroring your timelines in that system or bringing that system in under your shop would help or not. I'm not sure. The other thing is, my supporting you for this position, you mentioned that you taught at a law school and you taught legal writing. And one of the things that I was really interested in is that the product that's put out by your shop, the decisions, were really well written, well researched, so that they could stand up to a court scrutiny if, in fact, a person appealed them into the court system. How are you doing on that front?
Senator Terrio, through the chair, I think we're doing well. I think we've made some strides. I also think it somewhat contributes to sometimes delays in getting the decisions out. I don't like to do anything quick and dirty, especially in my own cases. We do have a pretty healthy peer review process we go through on the written work project as well, which can add a little bit of time to getting a decision out. But we, like every agency that's made up of a bunch of different human beings, we have people with differing levels of skills and skill sets. And so I think if you pull down kind of a random sampling off of our webpage, we're publishing our decisions. If you pull down a random sampling, you'd find some are more authoritative sounding, have more citations, and are better written than others. And I don't know exactly how to fix that other than we continue to move in the direction of trying to do appropriate work product for the case. As far as the complex cases with the thorny issues, they're going to be very thoroughly researched and hopefully well written as well. The cases that where the law is really straightforward and the only thing that is at issue is the facts, you're probably not going to see the same level of law review like citation you might see in some of the other more complex case decisions. But that was a long way around to saying I think the quality of the decision writing has improved since we became a central panel relative to when the functions were done in the different shops, but we're not as far along in that regard as I'd like us to be either.
Thank you.
Just a couple of short mechanical questions. How many ALJs do you have underneath you?
Seven underneath me. One is a deputy chief. The others are all full-time, devoted to almost nothing but hearing cases, and the deputy chief has some administrative duties. So we have about seven FTEs, if you will, hearing cases, because between my deputy and I, we probably equal on a bad day, we equal one FTE, but when we're really cranking, we're probably one and a half together. So.
And like the Alaska court system, are you spread out, you know, Juneau, Anchorage, Fairbanks, or are you concentrated in one place?
We are in Juneau and Anchorage, equally split, four judges and two staff members in each of the two locations. And we do a lot of our work telephonically, especially up until the point at which you need to have a complex case hearing. And most of those occur in Anchorage, it's where most of the lawyers are in the state. And so we don't have the same challenge the court system has of needing 44 whatever it is different locations for their courts. We travel when we need to, but much to my surprise, we don't have to travel out and incur the expense as often as you might think.
Thank you. That's all the questions I have for Ms. Thurbron. Any other questions? Senator Terrio, something on the tip of your tongue?
Yeah, I've forgotten. I'll ask her separately.
Okay. At this point, I would solicit a motion then. Senator Terrio.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the committee forward Ms. Thurbron's name forward to the full body for consideration.
Is there any objection to the motion? Hearing and seeing none, we'll take a brief at ease to do the necessary paperwork. Thank you for being
here
today, and please continue the great work.
Thank you.
Thanks, sir.
At ease. On the record, and we are back on the record, and we're here to take up the second matter come before the committee this afternoon, and that is Senate Joint Resolution Number 3. We have the resolution's prime sponsor, Senator Terrio, here with us. Senator Terrio, take it away.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate Joint Resolution Number 3 is designed to support a policy decision made under the Bush administration and encourage the continuation of that policy and perhaps expansion by the new administration in D.C. Is the intent of SJR 3 to show appreciation for the change that was made in the National Park Policy that allows park users to carry firearms they need for personal protection in the national parks. Alaskans who have in their state over 75% of the national park system understand how important it is to have personal protection when in the wilderness. And specifically in the parks in Alaska, I am more concerned about protection against the wild critters that live there, whereas in other areas of the country, protection in the national park system may be from other people who are in the park system. The bill affirms that progress has been made to allow carrying of firearms under the previous administration and encourages the new one to continue that. You know, whether it's for bear protection, obtaining food in a survival situation, or signaling for assistance when needed, firearms have been on the hips and arms and in the arms of many Alaskans since the frontier was first explored. And this is just to encourage that the current policy decision continues. With that, Mr. Stancliffe has done a lot of research in drafting up the resolution, and if committee members have specific questions, I can try and answer them, or perhaps Dave can.
Mr. Stancliffe, do you want to make yourself available for questions there at the witness table? Thank you, and welcome to the committee. I'll get us started. I have a bill packet that may just be one page short of a complete package or more, but I'm asking a question about the page that says FAQ, Interior Firearms Policy Update. And the bottom question on page one says, won't visitors and wildlife be endangered by allowing concealed firearms in parks and refuges? And there's no answer. So I'm going to turn to you and let you tell me what the answer is to that question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Dave Stancliffe, I'm aide to Senator Theriault. I've done extensive research on this issue because, as you can well imagine, people have varying opinions on whether they want to see firearms in national parks. And part of that research has revealed, as Senator Theriault indicated, some of the tragedies that have happened that would probably not have happened had people been able to defend themselves against wildlife. And but more interestingly, I discovered under government executive here the list of the 10 most dangerous national parks. And dangerous because of drug trafficking, dangerous because of assaults that have happened there. And so what we have is we have two groups of people wanting protection for two different reasons. And the policy is now being legally challenged. So as of the 30th of December 2008, the Brady Group has filed suit. And they did that after talking to the new appointment, Mr. Salazar, and him indicating that he's a big Second Amendment supporter, has been grown up with firearms, and is very comfortable with them in the hands of law-abiding citizens. He promised he'd take a look at the procedure to see if it was followed correctly, but the indication was that he wasn't going to do anything to reverse or try to politically in any way disrupt that decision. And at that point, the Brady Group has filed suit. So the timeliness of the resolution, from the standpoint that there are a very active group of people who are basically against firearms to begin with, who really have a problem with seeing them in our parks. And I do have that out of the Washington Post. So the question then becomes, and it's quite interesting here in the National Parks Traveler, which is kind of the National Parks communication internally, guns in the parks, do we need them? And, you know, the question could be guns in the parks, why wouldn't we want them? So it's really a philosophical. I believe Senator Theriault has in his packet, there was an article written by Craig Medrid, and the pushback from the people here in Alaska, as you can well imagine, significantly less in terms of the Park Service employees than in some places in the lower 48. So people recognize in Alaska you can be out in the middle of nowhere, as these two young ladies were last year that were lost in Denali Park, have no real way of signaling, no real way of protecting yourself, no real way of obtaining food if you needed a rabbit or some small critter to make a meal with. So it's a policy question, but as Alaskans, I think we can see both sides of it fairly clearly.
Couple questions. Any Alaska parks on that list of 10 most dangerous parks?
No. Interestingly enough, Senator Theriault brought up the same point, because all of these parks that were listed, they're dangerous from a people standpoint.
Right, right.
And in looking further into that, Senator Theriault discovered that not dangerous in fact that we don't have park rangers there and we don't have uniformed people there, but sometimes we don't have a lot of them there. And sometimes perpetrators find it very convenient that their victim or potential victim is way out in the wilderness alone. And so in some of our heavily used parks, and I'll just, if you wouldn't mind, I'll just read the top 10. The Oregon Pipe Cactus National Monument, that's on the border, drug trafficking, heavy illegal immigrant traffic. Big Bend, Texas-Mexico border, drug smuggling. Padre Island, Texas Gulf Coast, Shenandoah National Park, Northern Virginia, no reliable radio communications on eastern side of the park, reduced for ranger staff, plant and animal endangerment. Lake Mead National Recreation Area, east of Las Vegas, Grand Canyon, San Juan, Yosemite. And, you know, if you follow some of what's happening down in the lower 48, you understand why we've moved away from a conservation-looking uniform to a very law enforcement image, because and I think Senator Theriault brought it to my attention, some of the most dangerous law enforcement assignments have to do with our park rangers in our national parks, because anybody can hide behind a tree, and who's going to see you if someone takes you out? And so we really have a different image of park rangers than we used to have.
Mr. Chairman, just your specific question on the FAQ sheet. I think we only included the first page because we were talking specifically about the similar lands issue that is in the second one. So it was information that we thought answered some specific questions. I'm not sure what the answer was to that.
It's more of a rhetorical question than anything else. I'll just add an observation. I visited Brooks Lodge at Katmai many years ago. I went out there with my wife and we spent a week out there, and I was stunned to learn when we got there that you couldn't have a firearm to protect yourself. I mean, there are bears all over the place. And I just thought, well, that's crazy. I mean, there's bears. They're loose there, you know. And yet after a week in the park and going through their sort of, you know, their indoctrination program, bear school, right, you learn that it's very safe. There's been no bear attacks in Katmai since time out of mind, and if you obey certain rules, there won't be. And so I sort of swung from one extreme to the other after a couple of visits there. Now you think, well, that's great. There are, you know, there's not going to be any, you know, sort of trigger happy individuals popping a bear when all it is a bear walking to a salmon stream or carrying a fish. And yet Alaskans, you know, sort of have learned how to do that on the Russian River, on the Kenai River. All of our Alaskans, they figured out how and when to use guns and when not to. And so it's as you say, a philosophical.
It's important to note, Mr. Chairman, because you raise an important issue. This rule does not apply. That's been brought. That's been changed at the Bush administration. If a state does not allow concealed carry, then it is not allowed in the national park within that state. And the rationale was that the federal government was looking very carefully at what the states wanted to do, recognizing that perhaps Alaskans think differently than perhaps someone in Georgia or, you know, North Carolina. So there is a difference in policy, but it's based on what the states have in force. So
I also note that the third question says, what if a state doesn't want individuals to carry a concealed firearm in a park or refuge within its borders? Can it take action? And it says yes. That's possible. A state may wish to prohibit an individual from possessing concealed weapon on federal lands, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know whether they could sort of carve out a Brooks Lodge exception, and have one rule there, whereas you have a different rule in Denali National Park, which is more spread out. You know, Gates of the Arctic, same kind of thing, where you may more legitimately need a firearm to defend yourself, to signal for help, and so forth. Senator Elton, you had a question.
I do. At the risk of sounding like the senator from North Pole, I want to start with an umbrella question. Hmm. I mean, I think the thing that struck me about the resolution is I imagine there is a library full of federal regulations. And so, I mean, I guess the question is, and you used a term in your introduction of the resolution, that descend an appreciation. I mean, I sense the purpose of a resolution to be asking for a change. This resolution asks for a change, or suggests a potential change in one sense, but is essentially a resolution saying, you know, good job, thanks, keep it up. And we could draft or craft a ton of resolutions that say the same thing. And so I guess it's more of a philosophical question. Why are we doing a resolution to say kind of good job and don't change, instead of a resolution that says this is a problem, we need to address it?
Well, Mr. Chairman, it does say to the new administration that right now the regulation allows you to carry concealed in the national parks. Alaskans are comfortable, put it right on your hip. Let me see it. That's fine with me. In fact, some people prefer that. So the second resolve does talk about to continue and improve the rule. So there is the possibility. Number one, there's the call for some people, from some quarters, Coalition of National Park Retirees says this regulation will put visitors, employees, and precious resources in the national park system at risk. We will do everything possible to overturn it, return to a common sense approach to guns in national parks that has been working for decades. So there is an effort out there to undo this. And so we're basically putting the state of Alaska, the government of the state of Alaska, on record saying, no, we support what was done. We support the fact that it conforms to state law. Basically, if the state allows concealed carry, or to answer Senator French's question about could our state concealed carry be modified to particular, carve out a particular park? Yes, the federal regulation would allow that, just as we have allowed concealed carry, but you can't concealed carry in a women's shelter and in a court building. I mean, we could take a step if we want to, and the federal regulation would allow that. So we're basically saying we support the step that was taken just recently, and we're encouraging the new administration to resist the attempts to undo it, and to potentially even consider that you let people carry openly in the parks where states allow that.
Senator Elton.
Kind of a string of questions that kind of lead in. I guess I understand what you're saying, but I mean, we've also had testimony that the new administration, the new person in charge of Interior, saying that he agrees with the rule. So it seems to me, with the exception of expanding it to non-concealed, that the rest of the resolution seems superfluous. And I guess, and I'm trying to understand the process of adopting a federal regulation, but there is a huge, I mean, it would now take a new federal regulation to roll back to what we had before, and there is a huge period of time and a public comment period. So, I mean, it just seems to me, I guess I don't want to get into a practice of saying, hey, good job, don't change. I mean, especially given the number of federal regulations that are out there. And this is something that I don't know, and perhaps you or Mr. Stancliffe do know. Is it permissible now to carry a rifle? And has it been permissible to carry a rifle in a national park?
Mr. Chairman, I have some experience in that. I went hunting outside of Denali Park, and when we returned to our vehicle, which was actually there at the airstrip within Denali Park, laid down, went to sleep, so that we could be ready to fly out in the morning, and was waked up about 2 a.m. with banging on the side of the van and lights coming into the windows shining there on our unloaded rifles laying beside us. And we're threatened with confiscation of those weapons, actually, and eventually just took the bolts out of them and put the rifles out of sight. The answer is you cannot be packing a rifle in sight. If you have a firearm in a park, they're going to probably make you take the bolt out or break it down and put it in a location away from where others will see it, and maybe where you could avail yourself to using it. So there's been quite a change in policy, Mr. Chair.
So if I could just, so it's okay to have a rifle as long as it's not loaded and you have taken a step to remove the bolt and put it in a separate
right.
pack.
Right, and in course, in the preserves, it's okay to have them because they allow hunting, but in the, we're talking the hard park units. I don't know anybody that would take their rifle or shotgun in there for fear of having it confiscated. Now, if it's concealed, you're going to be okay now. But prior to this change of ruling.
So the only, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, so please. The only firearm that you're allowed to carry would be a concealed firearm.
That's
which
right.
is probably not possible with a rifle.
Very difficult.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Small gun.
Senator Terrio, question?
And, well, no, just in response to some of the other questions, I think that, that as was indicated in the Craig Medred column, Alaskans in particular, and according to the article, the people that work in the parks are very supportive of the change that was made by the federal government. So the government weighing into the process to encourage the new personnel for the new executive to not start an administrative process to undo it, I think by and large Alaskans support that, indicating to him on behalf of one of the 50 states, we like the change. We support the change. We wish the change went even a little further, but don't start the process to undo it. In addition, the policy that has been adopted by the Park Service is very similar to the policy for that BLM has on carrying on federal lands, and also the U.S. Forest Service follows very much along, so that the three federal entities will be operating under the same kind of guidelines.
Senator Elton.
I appreciate the clarification. I would just note that Forest Service and BLM, I mean, hunting is allowed and in the national park system, and the refuge is not.
And the preserves as well. Right. Mm-hmm. We do have one person signed up to testify from the Department of Natural Resources. Sally, it says Giebert. Is it Giebert or Gilbert or?
Sally Giebert.
Giebert. Ms. Giebert, welcome to the committee. We can hear you clearly. If you'll just go ahead and put yourself on the record, and we'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Okay. I actually did not call to testify. I was calling in as sort of an information person, but I can clarify one of the points that was just raised.
Please do.
Currently, all of the national park preserves and all of the national parks that were created in 1980 under ANILCA, the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, are open to hunting and are therefore open to the carrying of firearms. So this resolution, as well as the original Bush administration regulations, only apply to the pre-statehood, pre-ANILCA parks, which include basically the old core of Mount McKinley National Park, and old Glacier Bay, old Katmai, and Sitka and Klondike.
So if under the new rules, I can take a gun with me when I go climbing and shoot avalanches down.
Yeah. As long as they're concealed.
Wahoo. Thank you, Ms. Giebert. Any other questions? Oh, and as a clarification, if the state or if the park director for, say, Brooks Lodge decided that he or she had to have a no-gun zone, you know, around that stretch of river, would that be something that could be carved out by the state?
Yes. Yeah, the state would have. They're basically deferring to the state. So whatever the state can do, they would be able to do, and then the Park Service would be able to go along with that.
Same with McNeil River.
Yeah.
Thanks so much. Those are the questions I had. Any other questions for Ms. Giebert? Don't hear or see any. Other questions about the resolution? With that, I think I'll hold it over one hearing so I can just look into a couple of those questions that weren't included in the FAQ, and we'll bring them back up on Thursday. Nothing else to come before the committee? Adjourned.
Sorry, did you say